We live in our mobiles and our laptops, forever scrolling, texting, emailing, and working. Now artificial intelligence is taking us a step further, creating machines that are very close to having some form of consciousness, even perhaps refusing to be closed down or turned off. What were tools are threatening to become our masters, and in some respects, the great tech platforms and the companies that own them already are. Who holds power and shapes our thinking about now and in the future are being redefined, even what it means to be human. Philosophers have been trying to figure out how we come to know the world and how to create ethical and moral codes by which to live by ever since Plato and Aristotle. But few philosophers today try to engage with the threats and possibilities of today's digital world. One is Professor Carissa Valise, Associate Professor of Philosophy and the Institute for Ethics in AI at Oxford University and Fellow of Hertford College. A declaration of interest, she was one of my last appointments when I was the college's principal and already has made a name for herself as one of the most original, frontier-thinking philosophers that we thought she might when we hired her. In her first landmark book, Privacy is Power, she discussed the vital necessity of protecting our data as a precondition for sustaining our freedoms. But the algorithms constructed by AI and data don't just stop there. They have born a new era of database predictions masquerading as being objective scientific. But just as in the past, prediction morphs into prophecy, describing not just what might happen, but helping to make it happen by the act of forecasting. And nor are these predictions objective and scientific, but like all predictions, they're shaped by human choices, assumptions, and incentives. In her latest book, Prophecy, Prediction, Power, and the Fight for the Future, From Ancient Oracles to AI, Carissa Valise challenges us to see predictions not just as neutral forecasts, but as powerful forces that can shape choices, institutions, and entire societies. Amazing and challenging insights. Let's start, Carissa, with Privacy is Power. I have to say, I very much like this book. I thought it was really important. It still is important, reminding us all that our data shouldn't be commercialized and commoditized, but it's fundamental to our kind of freedom. Do you want to just spell that out?
Yes, thank you so much. Well, Privacy is Power was a book that I wrote very much in the middle of the pandemic when surveillance was increasing and data collection was increasing. And one of the sad facts is that it's still just as current, that nothing has fundamentally changed. Even with large language models, we have more of the same. Even though these days we hear a lot about AI and we're talking a lot about the problems of AI, much of the conversation seems to suggest that all of the problems are equally important or that are on the same level. And one of the boldest claims of Privacy is Power is that, no, it all starts with surveillance. Surveillance is the fundamental sin of digital technology and something that we used to only consider acceptable for suspects of criminal offences now funds the vast majority of the internet.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I don't think people kind of are aware that actually just using your mobile, using your laptop, using your PC reveals potentially so much about yourself. You have your protective code set on your kind of mobile and imagine that you're more or less, I mean, you kind of protective bubble, but you're not.
Yeah, and even more so, I'm not sure people realize the political implications of that. There is a good reason why we tend to associate surveillance with authoritarian regimes. And when we apply this level of surveillance to liberal democracy, what we're doing in practice is to ask how much surveillance can democracy take? And I really hope we don't find out, but I'm afraid that we might.
I mean, just, I think it's worth reminding people. I mean, Navalny, the Russian dissident who was murdered in jail, people just going to lay flowers on his memorial. Photographs are taken on them as they walk in or walk out. The state knows who they are. The way the Iranian authorities cracked down on the kind of huge uprisings in Tehran and all around kind of Iran, same story. Daily in China, these are without contemporary technology, the Russians, nor the Iranians, nor the Chinese could do what they do. And that technology is available in the democracies in the West.
Yes, and technology is not neutral. It's built to do something. And surveillance technologies are built to make it very easy to control, to track. And because we're social beings, what we tend to control the most and track the most is other human beings. So sure, you can use the technology to track your keys, but everybody knows that we're using it mostly to track other human beings. And if you think about East Germany, East Berlin, it was extremely expensive to have someone surveilled. And because it was so expensive, the state could only manage to surveil about a third or a fourth of the population, depending on estimates. But now, digital tech has made it so easy and so cheap that it's almost easier to surveil than not to, because the default has become data collection.
Just give us an example, Carissa, of what that means in a kind of democracy like ours.
Well, it means that your phone is picking up thousands of data points about you every day. And that includes things like, where do you live? Where do you work? Who are your friends? Who are your families? Who are your colleagues? Who do you talk with? What kind of things do you read online? How much do you owe? Your educational background, your political tendencies, your sexual practices, your purchasing power, your tastes in music, which might say things about your personality, but also whether you might be depressed. And all of that gets bundled into a data file that gets sold to the highest bidder. Sometimes it can be an insurance company or a bank or a prospective employer. And that means that it makes us all incredibly vulnerable, not only as individuals who, you know, you might be extorted for money or you might have your identity stolen, but also as citizens. And some of these citizens have important jobs. And so a couple of days ago or a few days ago, there was this story in the British press about how Labour went around surveilling journalists who were publishing uncomfortable stories about them. When journalists become so vulnerable because we're all carrying our phones, we are really endangering investigative journalism. And without a strong investigative journalism and a strong free press, there is no democracy. So without privacy, we don't have democracy.
Very, very compelling. I mean, would you say the same about, you know, what's very controversial in the States at the moment, the immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, kind of the work they're doing in kind of cities around, kind of sanctuary cities around the United States?
It's a constant in time and in geographies that one of the first things that governments who want to dominate citizens and non-citizens do is go after the data. This is something we see over and over and over again. And we should learn from history because it's so relevant.
The upsides of this technology. I mean, I enjoy Spotify, frankly. I like scrolling through X and LinkedIn on my mobile without access to my browsers. Where would I be? And I've even begun using ChatGPT, actually, which I find actually quite...
My condolences.
I know, it's a very, very, it's a very stultified language they use, actually. Kind of, it's like reading the dictionary as I reel off the things I use and I like, which are the upsides of this world. Are you thinking, well, I don't do any of that because I've written this book and I realize but doing any of that is to surrender too much data to the tech platform?
No, I do. And as an author, I need my book to be known. And the only way to do that these days is to be on social media. So I do. And I don't enjoy it. And I wish I didn't. However, much of what we do enjoy, so I enjoy Spotify and I enjoy Netflix or whatever it might be, we could have it without this surveillance system. Because that narrative is one that comes from the tech companies. You know, they tell us, sure, we surveil you, but look at how these shiny products fill your life. And of course, we could have the shiny products without the surveillance. So we listen to music way before Spotify ever came about. And sure, Spotify makes it easier to find some things. That convenience doesn't come from the surveillance. it comes from other technologies, and the surveillance is just a way to fund it. And there are other business models that are a lot less toxic for society. And here's the main problem, that all of that surveillance machine is put at the service of prediction. So my second book is about prediction, because it's the second greatest sin for digital tech. Because if companies and governments didn't want to try to predict what we're going to do next, they wouldn't have a reason to surveil us. And that prediction, as you mentioned in the introduction, is not neutral and it's not scientific. It's not like us trying to predict whether it's going to rain tomorrow. That prediction has no effect on the clouds. Whether it's going to rain or not is completely independent of that prediction. But when you make a prediction about a human being, that has an effect on that human being, not only because it can change their expectations, but it changes the expectations of everybody around them. And so there is this tendency for predictions to become self-fulfilling prophecy. So let me give you an example. In this journey of working in digital tech, I've met a guy who told me the story that every time he asks for a job the normal way through, you know, a LinkedIn application or a formal application, he gets denied by the algorithm. But then he gets offered these very high paying jobs by the CEOs of these tech companies. And there's something in his CV that is extraordinary. And algorithms don't do extraordinary. They are very good at making predictions based on the normal curve. But when you have someone who's different in some way, it doesn't know what to do with it. And so it tends to reject it.
What was the reason why the, was it a he or a she that was the, maybe,
it's a he.
It was a he.
He doesn't know.
He doesn't know what the something was in his CV.
No, nobody has figured it out, but he's a brilliant computer scientist and everybody wants him, except he can't apply the normal way because then the algorithms filter him out.
Is there an appetite for prediction and more accurate prediction that fallible human beings want to know? And I'd love to know. I can't imagine a world in which we're going to take away that appetite for having some better grasp of future behaviors.
No, we won't. But I think we can temper it and we can educate it and we can better understand what we're doing when we're either engaging in predictions or we're believing someone else's prediction. So what I propose is I look at my app every day to see if it's going to rain, you know, and if it says it's going to rain, I'm going to take my umbrella. However, there's a world of difference between that and using prediction for the purposes of dating apps and jobs and in the justice system and allocating resources when it comes to health. There has to be a public debate that we're not even having right now. So I think that the anxiety to know what the future holds is a very human characteristic. And it comes from the knowledge that we are incredibly vulnerable beings. We know that terrible things happen to other human beings every day, and we fear that they might happen to us. And so we want to know what the economy will be like next month and what neighborhood is going to be safe, who will win the election. And that has implications for our personal lives, for our business. However, that makes us incredibly vulnerable to charlatans because we are so anxious to know what the future holds that we will give money to basically anyone for them to reassure us. And the main product of prediction is anxiety relief. It's giving you the illusion that it's going to be okay because you know what the future holds. But the fact of the matter is that the future is unwritten and it's completely unpredictable. And not only that, the most important events in your life and in our collective lives are the most unpredictable. So it's really easy to see what's ahead when the road is completely straight. It's the curves that make it hard. And it's the curves that we really would like to know about. And so having the illusion that you know what the future holds, when in fact you know less than ever, is actually not going to help you. One of the characteristics that we would do well to cultivate as individuals, as business people, as policymakers, as politicians, whatever you are, is the ability to sit with uncertainty. And in many difficult situations in life, the person who has more tolerance for uncertainty is the one who can keep a cool head and be realistic and kind of win in that game. The other thing is the benefits of uncertainty. So even though it can create a lot of anxiety not to know what the future holds, I would like to remind people that is a fantastic thing that you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Because if you did, it would be very bad news. It would mean that we don't have a democracy. And it would mean that you have no influence over the future. If you feel uncertainty about the future because you don't know what's going to happen, it means that you can probably influence it. And that is the most important aspect of our lives, our ability to influence the future.
I'm hearing a philosopher talk here. I now see the linkage between philosophy, which is your chosen discipline, and your interaction with all this stuff. I now get it. I'm a Keynesian economist. I'm very influenced by Keynes. And I mean, he draws an important distinction between uncertainty that is absolutely unknowable and probabilities where actually you can attempt to kind of, there's a range of things which could happen and some are more likely than others. And then there's what's absolutely unknowable. Now, you're talking about what's absolutely unknowable. I agree with you completely. But when you're talking about probabilities, where you're assigning mathematical values to particular outcomes, surely it's reasonable enough to try and get an algorithm to do all that work for you rather than spend days, months trying to collect the data yourself.
Yeah, in some cases, yes. So for example, if we're trying to predict the weather, that's great. Let's use an algorithm. Or if we're trying to predict something like, I don't know, the quality of air tomorrow in a particular place. However, when it comes to people, there are many, many problems. One is this thing about how we're not treating them as agents. But another problem is how even when it comes to probabilistic determinations, all too often companies interpret them in binary ways. So let me give you an example. Let's suppose that I use all the data about you and I infer that there is a 70% chance that you're a smoker. And let's suppose that you're not a smoker, but a company is not going to care. As long as the probability is high enough, it's easier to treat you as a smoker. And that means that you might not get a job or that you might have to pay higher premiums for your insurance or all kinds of other things. And nobody cares about the truth and nobody cares about justice and nobody cares about what you think about this. And so even when it comes to algorithms that might not predict a particular future, but might just give a percentage risk, the way we are using those predictions are incredibly problematic. It's interesting, right now, anyone can make any prediction about you without asking for your permission, without telling you that they're making a prediction about you, and using it in pretty much any way without any kind of supervision or public debate about whether this is okay.
Yes, it's astonishing. I find this very compelling. I mean, you're right. How does the kind of woman in the street, the man in the street, handle all this? How can you deal with a false oracle, if you like, a false prophet?
Well, in a variety of ways. The first one is to understand that AI, machine learning in particular, the kind of AI that we're using, is nothing but a predictive machine. Whether it's predicting the output of text or an image, or whether it's making a decision about a loan, the only thing that it does is prediction. And so to bear in mind that when you're dealing with AI, you're dealing with a probabilistic analysis. You're not dealing with facts. And the second thing is that when you hear a prediction, say by a tech executive or a politician or whoever the prophet might be, to pause for a second, recognize it as a prediction, and then realize that there are power plays there. So often predictions are very misleading because they sound like descriptions of the world or hypotheses about the future of the world. So somebody might say, in the future, we will use AI for everything. And when you analyze the speech behind a prediction, you realize that in the words of J.L. Austin, who was a philosopher who studied speech, this is a speech act. So Austin had this idea that we do things with words. We don't only describe the world, but we do other things with words. So for example, when you tell your child that they have to clean up their room, what you're doing is commanding that they do something, and that's doing something with words. So when a prophet says, tomorrow we're going to use AI for everything, what they're doing is actually ordering. It's an order. They're telling you, go out there, by AI, they are instilling the fear of missing out in you and fulfill my vision of the world, which interests me because, you know, they have a company that produces AI and it's going to make them even richer. And the appropriate attitude towards a prediction is not to believe it automatically. It's not to treat it as a fact, but to question it. So ask questions. Who is this guy? Why is he making this prediction? Who is this prediction going to benefit? Is it made with data? What kind of data? Who collected the data? Why? And then defy it. If it's a prediction that, if it's not the world you would like to live in, then the appropriate response is to defy it, is no, tomorrow we won't use AI for this because we as a society decide that it's not appropriate. So I try to remind readers of the power we have. We are more empowered than we think in the choices we make in our everyday lives. And every time we choose, for example, analog instead of digital, we protect ourselves from these kind of prophecies and these kind of false prophets. So every time you choose to read a paper book instead of a Kindle book, part of what you're doing is protecting yourself from this world of the new prophets.
We'd like to tell you about another podcast from our friends over at The Conversation. They're a not-for-profit news and analysis platform pairing academics with journalists on every story. In their podcast, The Conversation Weekly, host Gemma Ware sits down with an academic expert every week to discuss a topic in the news to understand how we got here. From global politics to the latest scientific breakthroughs or the big dilemmas facing our planet, they talk to experts from all over the world who draw on years of research knowledge to pull out what really matters so that you can understand the context without the spin. New episodes of The Conversation Weekly land every Thursday, and you can find them wherever you get your podcasts. What are the ethical responsibilities? I mean, do you think the companies that are involved in this kind of own the ethical responsibilities that they have when they make predictions? I'm thinking actually about the prediction markets. It's only 10 years ago, the prediction markets were comparatively tiny, but now it's $60 billion worth of trade in the prediction markets. I mean, it's an astonishing development. What do you make of that?
It's astonishing. It worries me because the people who defend prediction markets defend them a few arguments that I find very questionable. So one argument is that it's the closest thing we have to truth because when people's money is at stake, they bet for what they really believe in. And when a lot of people come together, we get something like the wisdom of the crowds. And there are at least two things wrong with that main argument in favor of prediction markets. The first is that we will get the wisdom of the crowd, because for the wisdom of the crowds to kick in, and for anyone who's not familiar with the term, the idea is that when we don't know something, if you ask a lot of people who are very different from one another and very independent, their level of knowledge and their perspective sort of even out in a way that we get as close to truth as we can, and much better than any single individual. However, for this phenomenon to kick in, people need to be independent. So they need to have different knowledge from different places and have different perspectives. But often in our digital world, when one story goes viral, everybody has the same source and the same amount of knowledge. And so instead of getting the wisdom of the crowds, we might get the tyranny of the majority.
Bubble effects, really.
So that's the first problem. But the second problem is this idea that, well, if you put your money into something, you're doing it sincerely. But when you have enough billions in your bank account, you might be very willing to place a bet on a prediction that you wouldn't bet on if you thought it was a scientific enterprise, but that you're trying to make that prediction into a self-fulfilling prophecy. So one or two things will happen. Either you have enough clout and enough power and enough money to make it happen, or if you lose, you have enough money or you have enough investments in different predictions that counterweight each other that you don't care.
So how are you going to make the actors in prediction markets, the companies that run the digital platforms, the companies that are involved in developing AI algorithms that allegedly predict the future, how are you going to make them all listen to you, Carissa? A free marketeer, they would all say, well, you know, it's very nice, you know, this conversation, but actually any AI company that consistently writes abusive algorithms, the markets will find them out and they'll lose business, but they'll have to watch their reputation. So ultimately, the market will arrive at optimal solutions without all this worrying. What's your answer to that?
I think it's just empirically obvious that the market doesn't do that. And in particular, when we have such huge asymmetries of power, then somebody can be rich enough to distort the market in profound ways. And also that we are so bombarded by information and by fake news and by notifications and so overwhelmed that nobody can track anything anymore. It's mostly noise out there. And also there are scandals that are so scandalous that it just seems like sometimes we are maxed out with scandal. And just to get an example, the Epstein files, they're just like so horrendous and so, it seems like not enough is happening from it. Like if every single person in there actually had to face consequences, the network is so large. So there are all kinds of distorting effects from power that makes it that not the case. But let's talk about practical issues. Like, what is the upshot here, right? The ambitions can be wide and it depends. I think, you know, at a minimum, if all citizens were much more aware and much more critical of what predictions are, how are they being used, and much more savvy about identifying and questioning them, we would already have a better quality of democracy just on the basis of having a more informed citizenry. So even if that was the only effect of this public debate, that would be valuable enough. But then I think we have business people, and I think there are a lot of reasons for why a CEO and C-suite executives or we would want to be more critical about predictions, because often they're being sold AI, like this thing that if they don't have, they're missing out on, and that's actually making them a lot more vulnerable to some of the biggest risks in their companies. So if this book can lead executives to build more robust companies, that would also be already incredibly valuable, not only for the companies themselves, but for society as a whole. Because when our companies are more robust, that means that as a society, we will be more robust as well. And then we come to policymaking. And I think this is the trickiest part. I don't know which would be the perfect kind of regulation for predictions. And partly, this is a very different book than Privacy is Power, because with Privacy is Power, I suggested what the regulations should be. I think we had much more experience with that, and it was much clearer to me. In this book, it's more like, we're not even having the conversation. We should put on the table the question of how predictions should be regulated. It's clear to me that it's not okay to just allow anyone to make a prediction about anyone else in any context with any kind of consequence and then have no kind of framework or guidelines. But what is the answer? I don't know. But for example, I think some things might be clear. If somebody's going to make a prediction about you that's going to make it more or less likely that you will get important life opportunities, you should at least be notified that it's happening, which is not the case. And for certain
or conversely, you know, diminish your life opportunities. I mean, you know, yeah.
You should at least know of it. Conversely, for certain kinds of things, for example, in the justice system, we shouldn't use prediction because the justice system is supposed to be based on what you did and what you deserve on the basis of what you did, not on what the future holds and not on what somebody thinks about you in the future. So I think there are some areas in which we can gain more clarity, and then we have to have a conversation.
It's rather a revelatory conversation, this, actually. I mean, I don't think many people listening will have actually got this far. I mean, in their own thinking about it. I mean, when I was alerted to you, I mean, the first book, Privacy is Power, I mean, was all very clear. This is much more problematic, I think, and it's missing, you acknowledge that.
Yes, it's problematic because we do need predictions. But for example, another line that I think we should draw is between individual prediction and population level prediction. It's clear that we need to know roughly how many people in 100,000 are going to get a heart attack so that we can have the resources to attend to them, and insurance companies need to know, etc. But from that to trying to predict whether anyone in particular is going to have a heart attack, that is morally much, much, much more problematic. And at the moment, what we're seeing, the trend in insurance is to go from population level predictions to individualized prediction. And what that means in practice is that insurance loses its reason to be, because insurance is about pooling risks.
Yep.
And once you start billing people for their individual risks, well, people might just as well not have insurance at all and pay for their own way, because that's essentially what we're getting to.
How does philosophy help you get to answers to these fundamental questions you've been raising?
I've had a lot of fun in this book. I don't know if it shows, but this book is post-tenure. And so this time I really wrote the book that I wanted to write. One of the stories that I get into in the book is how ancient Greece was obsessed with divination, and we have inherited that kind of poison. But just like jewelweed tends to grow next to poison ivy and be the antidote to it, ancient Greece also gave us philosophy. I don't mean this very metaphorically. I mean that, you know, ancient philosophers did rise in connection and as a challenge to a lot of the other trends that were happening related to myths and divination and this kind of magical thinking.
That's interesting. So you're saying that, you know, Aristotle and Plato and others, Socrates, they're surrounded by kind of all the lunacy of oracles and all the lunacy of myth. And so they start kind of engaging with, let's ask some hard questions about all this.
Exactly.
So you're saying that you're inheriting their mantle, Carissa, 2,000 years later, in challenging allegedly scientific objective predictions and saying, no, come on, let's really quarry into this. There's some madness here.
Exactly. We need more. I mean, obviously I'm biased, but we need more philosophy. We need people to be much more critical against these prophets that very often end up being charlatans.
Well, you're hoping, showing that philosophy is really a branch of social science there, Carissa. looking for ever where you cross over from being a humanity to being a social scientist. Look, it's been a fantastic conversation, and I think both books, actually, Privacy is Power, Prophecy, Prediction, Power, and the Fight for the Future, From Ancient Oracles to AI, promises to be no less significant and important. So thank you very much. Thank you. Very great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Will.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.